This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing and the Wisconsin Writers Association, and always streaming at rightscast.net. If you tuned in to the most recent episode of this program, you know our last guest mentioned writers of thrillers and mysteries are known for their unparalleled abilities to craft spellbinding plots. Well, our guest for this episode is one such writer, and he joins us to share his seven touchstones for writing a mystery or thriller. Even if you're not a writer of mysteries or thrillers, stay tuned. What he has to offer over the course of this interview can be widely applied across genres. Hey there, I'm author, writing coach, and RightsCast Network founder R.R. Campbell, and welcome to episode 82 of your listener-supported R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing and the Wisconsin Writers Association. For this episode, I'm joined by Nick Chiarkis, author of Weepers. Nick Chiarkis grew up in the Al Smith housing projects on Manhattan's Lower East Side. When he was in fourth grade, his mother was told by the principal of PS1 that, quote, Nick was unlikely to ever complete high school, so you must steer him toward a simple and secure vocation. Instead, Nick became a writer with a few stops along the way. A U.S. Army paratrooper, a New York City police officer, the deputy chief counsel for the President's Commission on Organized Crime, and the director of the Wisconsin State Public Defender Agency. On the way, he picked up a doctorate from Columbia University, a law degree from Temple University, and was a Pickett Fellow at Harvard. How many mothers are told their child is hopeless? How many kids with potential simply surrender to desperation? That's why Nick wrote Weepers, for them. I'm thrilled Nick could join me for this episode, and after listening to it, I'm sure you'll understand why. So let's get to it then, my conversation with author Nick Chiarkis. Stay tuned after our dialogue for updates about what you can expect next from the RightsCast Network, and thanks, as always, for listening. Thank you so much, Nick Chiarkis, for joining me for this episode of the R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network.
It's an honor to be here, and I enjoyed talking to you, Ryan. Ryan, do you prefer Ryan or R.R.?
I am open to either, whichever one rolls off your tongue a little more smoothly. That's okay by me.
Okay, then can we do Ryan? That rolls off a little bit easier with my New York accent.
You know, I will say for most people, Ryan does roll off the tip of the tongue, so we can absolutely embrace Ryan. And I should say, Nick, I really appreciate that you were able to accommodate a retaping of this episode. We did have some technical difficulties with take one, so we have some practice, like you and I discussed in the pre-recording chat. So why don't we get right into the meat of the episode today? We're talking about the seven touchstones for writing a mystery or thriller. But before we dive in too deep, I just want to know, Nick, do you see this process as being relevant to writers in other genres as well?
Absolutely. I think it would work in any genre. I've written nonfiction as well, and I'm not as sure as I am with any other genre or an autobiography or a memoir. I think it all works.
And I think that that's something that's really great to know going forward here, because though we'll be framing it more from your background in the world of fiction, this is stuff that really has some great universality to it. And so that we can start to get a feel for how universal all of this is, and just so that we can provide context for listeners, we're going to be talking about seven different steps today. But before we get into the detail on all seven steps, Nick, would you mind listing what those seven steps are before we get into them in detail?
Happy to. And let me just say on the outset, it grew out of, I do a presentation, actually, I was going to be at Lake Fly last week, on writing a novel from idea to publication. So taking that, as you said, it could apply to anything. I wanted to see how to write a mystery, which is what I do. And here are the, let me first tell you what the seven touchstones are. The first one is finding an idea. How do you go about finding an idea for the mystery? The second, how to start What's my first line? Do I do an outline? The third are focusing in on the characters in a mystery. The fourth, I call the corners. In a mystery, unlike maybe other genres, you are going to put your protagonist in corners that it will appear he could not possibly get out of. You're going to do it on purpose. The sixth is the story and keeping the promise to your readers. And we can talk about that in more detail. And finally, number seven is the end. How do I end this story with showing the reader that it is both inevitable and a surprise at the end? And oftentimes, I'll say this right away, people know how a mystery thriller, they know the inevitability of James Bond surviving and getting through to the end okay. What they don't know is how is he going to do it. So it should be inevitable and a surprise. And those are the seven touchstones.
And so we had then, just a recap for listeners here, we're starting in number one with an idea. Number two is the beginning, deciding how we're going to start. Three was character. Four was writing yourself into corners. Five, and I think we might have skipped five, but five I do believe is plot related. It has to do with clues and red herrings. And then we go into six. That is that one. Okay, great. Very good. So we have clues and red herrings for five. Six was story. And seven, we get into endings. And I know you'll regale us with a really great story when it comes time to talk endings at the end of our conversation here. But we can't jump ahead to seven. No, we have to get more detail on step number one. And that pertains to ideas. So can you elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by this first step of having an idea, and where do we get ideas for stories?
And that is a question that comes up at every writer's conference that I've been to. You can get the idea, and we hear this a lot, get the idea from almost any place. But it doesn't just jump in our lap. We have to work a little to get the idea. So, for example, if I have a newspaper, I might have a group read a story on page one and then look and read a story on page seven. And let's imagine how those two things relate. An idea could come from there. Also with idea, you have to wrestle with the point of view, from whose point of view. So let's look at those two things. And the most important thing when you get that idea, when it lands in your lap, when it's something that you really want to write, scribble it down. Sit down at a table and just scribble down a story as though you're talking to me. Don't worry about research. Don't worry about errors. Don't worry about grammar. Don't worry about anything. Just write your story down. Just scribble it on down. And I think when you do that, you will develop additional ideas. They'll come to you. It's not a muse that suddenly you get an idea, but it's the work of it. So, for example, I used to like to play with my kids. We'd go into a restaurant, we'd sit there. I was a single dad, had two kids, and we would try to imagine who the other people in the restaurant were and why they're there and what they're going to do. And it was kind of a fun game. And you can do that. You can do that with yourself or with someone else. Listen to conversations. Ask folks to tell you stories about, especially older folks, about when they were growing up. All of your ideas will come from this. And the key word, the key thing you must remember is what if. If you're writing a mystery thriller, to everything you're hearing and looking at, you're saying what if. Second thing, I'll be quick about this, is everybody tells you to write what you know. Don't write what you know. Write what you want to know. You're going to spend a lot of time writing a mystery. 75% of it should be research and 25% should be writing. You want to, that doesn't mean that you have no familiarity at all with it. I was a New York City cop, but I don't know how the detective bureau worked, and I don't know the politics about being a police chief. And part of the thing I had to do with Weepers is research that and find out more about it. But it interested me. And that's what you want. You want something that you're very interested in. You want to locate it in a place that you want to know more about. It could be a place that you've been to. But certainly you should go on site. And all of this will give you the idea for the story. And I know that was a long-winded way of saying that's how you find an idea. But you could find them instantly. You can find them right now by opening up a newspaper or magazine randomly and picking a couple of sentences and then opening up someplace else and say, what if? What if this relates to them? And what kind of a story does that make?
And what I really like about what you're saying, Nick, is that it seems like no matter what venue or what medium you turn to try to stimulate your creativity and to try to develop these ideas, what it comes down to is the notion, yes, of what if, but even at a deeper level, it's this idea of fueling our curiosity and knowing that, well, if I want to know more about this, then perhaps a reader will too. And as we encourage ourselves not to stymie any of the thoughts that we might have in the early stage and to truly just be free and play in that sort of writer's sandbox, build a little castle, knock that one over, see what happens kind of thing, we allow ourselves to let that curiosity go uninhibited, and that can lead us to some really interesting places, I would have to imagine. But of course, Nick, once we have an idea, regardless of how we have this idea and we feel like we're ready to get going with it, well, then, yeah, we have to get going with it. We have to take decisive action. And there's a lot out there about pantsing or outlining. But for you, it seems like in this second touchstone, you have a little more nuance to that. So what is the nuance to the process of getting started for you? And what does that look like?
Good question. And I like everything you just said. I wish, actually, that I said that.
We'll just change the, we'll do a voice modulator and we'll make it sound like you.
Okay, so how to start? What do I write down first? I'm sitting there staring at that blank page. How am I going to begin? And part of it is, am I going to begin with an outline, as you say, or am I going to begin by the seat of my pants, which we talk about as pants? And let me back up just one second, and I'll try to do this with each touchstone. The difference between writing a mystery thriller and another genre, in the first one and in this one, is with other genres, usually the question is why. What's going to happen? What do I write about? In a mystery thriller, the question is how. It's not about what. It's about how. And that's an important distinction that might not exist in other genres. So now I'm going to create an outline. That's easy. And I say it's easy because there are a ton of books about how to outline your book, quick ways to outline your book, and to outline it in great detail, to outline it roughly. Patterson likes to make an outline for every one of his books, and he'll make a rough outline first, and then he'll make a very detailed outline, almost the kind of outline where now you just plug in the information. Dan Brown, I think, does pants for about three chapters, and then he'll stop and make an outline the next several chapters, and then and he'll just continue. And I sometimes refer to that as you can mix and match different styles. What I like is to list the implication points. Those are the points at which Angelo sets fire to a store. Undercover cop is held in the park. And that's all I'll say about it. I'll have just bullets down a page, and I'll rearrange them from time to time. An implication point, I call it that because in the business world, when you're looking at a graph and you suddenly see it go up, or we could be talking about the virus, or you see it dropping, that place where it moves, where it goes up or drops, is the input. Something happened on that point, and it changes the arc. It changes the story a bit. So I like to make a list of implication points. To some extent, that is kind of an outline, and in other ways, it's pants, because those implication points will be erased at some point, maybe, or they'll change.
Here it is, our moment of Dandelion Web Marketing. Yes, this episode is brought to you by the folks of Dandelion Web Marketing, who help writers build thriving author platforms through strategic web marketing. If you're not sure if you're headed the right direction with your website, well, one of their author website audits can help you find out. Right now, listeners to the Writescast Network can receive 50% off one of Dandelion Web Marketing's author website audits, and this audit will look at your content, security, design, search engine optimization, and more, and it'll provide you with insight into what you might do to better reach the audience you serve. So to learn the strengths and weaknesses of your current website and save 50% along the way, visit dandelionwebmarketing.com/writescast to learn more. That's dandelionwebmarketing.com/writescast. And it seems again, too, that even at this stage of the game, we're bringing it back to this idea of finding the process that works for us, like we did in step one, right? It was about giving ourselves space to explore, to find the idea in the shape that we need to find it, so that we feel inspired to let our curiosity take us where it may. And the same thing happens too once we get started with our novels. Sure, there's a lot of prescriptivist advice out there about how to outline. There's a lot of people who will insist that you must write by the seat of your pants in order to achieve the pinnacle of creativity. But as it turns out, Nick, for both your experience and for some of the authors you've named, and even for me as I continue to grow as a writer, there really are so many opportunities to be in that in-between. And so long as we are comfortable with our idea and we're comfortable with our process, well, that's the first two of your seven touchstones here, so it seems like we'll be in good shape.
And that is terribly important. I want to repeat what you said. Whether you're using an outline or you're doing it by the seat of your pants, let your imagination run wild. Don't feel confined to anything. In Weepers, I had Angelo walking through the projects and he sets fire to a store. But I had to ask myself, what is he seeing along the way to the store? What is he feeling? What does he smell? How does it smell at 2 o'clock in the morning going through there? You have to do all of that. You have to let your imagination fly with you. So whether it's an outline or pants, be there. Be there with your characters. I think that's crucial. And I think that's what you said. I love it.
And what I really like about what you've said there is that you've walked us through, again, the idea of idea, the idea of playing in a certain space and finding that process we're comfortable with. But you also mentioned very critically at the end there, this idea of being with our characters. And as it turns out, that is the third touchstone out of your seven. And because we know that character drives story, well, we were going to have to talk about them at some point. So Nick, where do characters come into play for you? And what should we keep in mind when it comes to characterization?
Great. And I'm going to give you one more thing in answering that. Joyce Carol Oates says the way to start a novel, if you don't know any other way to start a mystery, start with this line, and this is directly from her. An unsolved mystery is a thorn in the heart. She gives us all permission to use that as our very first line. And that makes up our first paragraph. Now she says, write the second paragraph. Then throw away my first line. And that's the beginning of your story, your second paragraph. Which I think is just a beautiful way to just try to do it. And I think that would work with a memoir. What I thought of was a mystery as a kid, and it would work with a thriller. Characters. The characters are the best. The characters, you have to make me the reader. It's not enough to give me a great first line and to capture me. You have to make me care about the character, especially if you're going to kill him off in the first page or so. I want to know that character. Not all the details. You don't have to describe. I describe a priest as being built like a fire hydrant, and that's the only description you got. Basically, you focus on the kind of information that makes this character real for you. You're writing about this character. And it could be somebody you know. You could be an uncle that you like or dislike. You could use his characteristics and imagine what he might say. But you must know the character. And there's lots of ways to do it. Laurel York wrote a book called Take Your Characters to Dinner. I like to think of it as, and I actually really do this. I pretend I'm sitting at a table having tea and pound cake. Tea and pound cake for a very specific reason I won't go into, but tea and pound cake with the character. And I'm talking to this character over the tea and the pound cake. And then I switch point of view. And it's from the character having tea and a pound cake with me. And by doing that, getting to know this character, I know what I want the character to do. But it's important that the character act and behave, forgive me for this, in character as we move along. Characters. Limit the number of your main characters, your protagonist and your antagonist, and make your antagonist likable. What we used to say years ago is have him save the kitten. You need to make your antagonist likable in some way, even though he might die, but you have to understand him. In the same way, your protagonist must be a bit annoying. Can't just, when I first wrote Weepers, I named the main character Nick after me. And I couldn't get that character to do anything bad. And so I had to change the name immediately and put me someplace else. And then I was able to work and understand this character. Your secondary characters also should be detailed. And you should know about them, and you should have a feeling for them. Again, they're limited in some way. A danger, though, is to introduce a secondary or third-level character who is fascinating, but you never see her again, or you never hear from him again. If you get me interested in a character, I'm waiting to see the character once more. I want to see what he does or she does. So be careful with that. Make your characters distinct. I want to know who's talking without you saying. Nunzio said, I know how Nunzio sounds when he talks, and I know how his lawyer Declan sounds when he talks. Make your characters distinctive. Even their personalities. You can make one nervous. There's thesauruses that you can get on our emotions and what tapping a foot means or chewing on a lip. Use all your senses. But limit and define your characters, your main characters, is crucial.
And it seems like you've given us a lot to work with there, and I really appreciate that, because when it comes to something like character, as you have mentioned very rightly, we need our characters to be distinct from one another, and in the example you gave, they need to be sometimes separate from us so that we can write a character as opposed to perhaps writing a person who may not be willing to go on the journey that we have in store for our story. So there's a lot to think about there as it pertains to character and a lot of strategies that we can employ as we see fit and as what works with our process, as we mentioned a little earlier. But that brings me now to this next step in our touchstone, right? We have this idea of writing ourselves into corners. And this, the first time I saw you mention this in an email, I thought to myself, well, that seems unusual, but I've had a chance to hear you talk about it. I saw it in a blog post. So I want you to share with listeners now, if you would, why is it that the fourth touchstone is on writing yourself into corners?
So, now that you have these characters and you kind of know them, especially the first, especially your protagonist and your antagonist, but also others. Let me make clear, when I say write them in a corner, I'm not saying, and this is unique to a mystery thriller, I think, I'm not saying outline the corner and exactly how the character is going to get out of that, you know, these locked door mysteries. I'm saying write yourself into that corner. You writing it. You put your character in a situation that you don't know how he or she is going to get out of it. You don't know what happened. Suddenly he disappeared. At the beginning of Weepers, Angelo is with his father. Angelo's 7 years old. He's with his father on Christmas Eve. They're walking along together, and Angelo turns around, and his father is gone. No cars moving, nobody else on the street, nothing. He's just gone. When I wrote that, I had no idea what happened to his father. I wanted to know, but I had no idea. And when you write a mystery thriller from this perspective, what I want most, and I'll say this again later, what I want most is for my reader to continue to say these four words, and then what happened? And if they're saying, and then what happened, they're turning the page. And I want to keep them turning the page. And I'm turning the page. I did not know what happened to Mac when he disappeared in 1951. By the time the book was halfway finished, I knew what happened to Mac. But a whole lot of other things. There are a lot of other corners other people were pointed into, other characters were shoved into by me that I wasn't sure how I was going to deal with them either. And it makes it admit, I think if I can't guess what happened at that point, neither is my reader. And if I care enough about that character to want to know, so will my reader. And so the corners for a mystery thriller might be very different. I think they would be than other genres. Other genres, somebody will always, there has to be tension, right? So somebody will always wrestle with tension. Should I do this or do that? But if I do this, then I'll lose that. That's different. These are corners that you can't imagine how the person's going to come out of. And I say that you should write not only your main character into a corner, but also your secondary character must be in a corner. They're going to take a risk that they didn't want to necessarily, but they're in a corner, and they just, and you don't know how they're going to get out. It is the most fun you could have writing them into corners. So do that.
I would say that as someone who was a longtime outliner who recently finished a manuscript that was written mostly by the seat of my pants, that I certainly wrote my characters and myself into corners more often than I would normally be comfortable with. But I will say that after having done that, I found that, well, I think we're going to have a novel with more significant surprises than might have been the case otherwise. And I think that will only be a boon for readers who will be asking themselves, hopefully, time and time again, and then what happened? So I can say as a reformed outliner or as someone who has softened his stance on it, Nick, that that is all ringing very true for me anyway.
And it's fun to do that too, isn't it?
It is.
As the writer, fun to do that.
It absolutely is. And one of the amazing things is that it brings this interesting new challenge as well, right? And I think that there are some people who might hear this and go, well, that sounds like you're just giving yourself writer's block. And no, I would say that that's not the case. What I'd say is that it's testing your creativity muscles, right? It's kind of like going up a weight class or something like that in wrestling, or it's adding another 5 pounds to both sides of the dumbbell. And you might not think you're ready, or you might not think that that's something you can lift up. And maybe it takes you a few days or a few attempts to really get it up over your head. But when you do, you're going to feel really good about it because you put in a lot of work and you know it's something that maybe you weren't feeling up to previously. So I don't know. That's my take on it anyway. You know who we haven't talked about in a while? Scrivener. And I say Scrivener as if it's a person, as if it's a who. Well, to me, it kind of is, because Scrivener has been there for me at every stage of my writerly journey, at least going back to, 2010, 2011? We've had almost a decade together now, and I'm really grateful for what Scrivener has been able to offer me in terms of its ability to get me to the page right away without any kind of loading time whatsoever. I can hop in between chapters with ease, very minimal scrolling, and it helps me keep my manuscript organized. Yes, Scrivener is one of those incredible pieces of software that takes you beyond the world of simple word processing and keeps writers in mind throughout its interface. So, if you would like to get in on trying Scrivener for free for 30 days and help out the WritesCast network along the way, head to bit.ly/writing software to learn more and to give it a try for 30 days. If it turns out Scrivener is just too much tuna for you, well, that's fine. Back on out, use whatever software works for you, but I can say from personal experience that I would not be where I am today if it weren't for a product like Scrivener. So again, the place to visit on the web to make sure you help the WritesCast network along the way is bit.ly/writing software.
Oh, I think that's a wonderful example, because the surprise that you did it, the effort that you knew you would do it, the inevitability of you doing it and that you did it, you have your readers cheering for you because they're making that effort along with you. And that's a wonderful thing to do.
And it also, I think, in some ways, ties in to your seventh touchstone. Not that we're there yet, but the idea that we want our endings to be inevitable yet surprising. Well, if we have a number of checkpoints along the way that also feel inevitable and yet are surprising, we can create this really interesting buildup to an ending that, well, this feels kind of familiar because we've been given these surprises along the way, but if your ending takes that slightly different angle, or if it manifests in a different way than the previous inevitable surprises, well, then that's all the more reason for your book to be remembered long after it has been read. So, you know, nice synergy here from steps 1 through 7, I guess.
Yeah, and what you said, you know, without jumping to 7, as much as you want your opening to hook the reader and get them turning pages, in the end, you want the readers to be coming back for more of your, for the next thing you write, to ask you, is there a sequel coming? I mean, that's really what you want to do through it. So your reader saying, and then what happened? And then what happened is wonderful.
And I know that we're going to continue to work our way toward that step 7, and we'll get into endings in more detail here shortly, but we have two more steps that we want to make sure we give justice to first. And of course, That means we stop along the way at step 5, because now that we've written ourselves into some corners, we've written our characters into corners, we're starting to build now these sort of action-reaction chains. This forms the building blocks of plot, and now, in the case of a mystery or thriller, we need to talk about clues and red herrings. So where do those kind of figure into all of this?
Good. And so, and let's just dribble a little bit into 6 as well. So E.M. Forster said, the difference between story and plot. The king died, and then the queen died, is the story. The king died, and then the queen died of grief, is a plot. And so the closeness of them, the information, what you want to write about is all story. Plot is the fun stuff. Plot is the footprints in the snow of the story. So plot is where you want to lead clues and red herring. Red herrings lead you to an innocent person, or lead you to the wrong person, or lead you someplace else. It was said at one point, I think I mentioned this, it was said at one point that, I forget the writer, but years and years and years ago, when a thief was running away and dogs were chasing him, they would bury fish, and the kind of stinky fish, and they would throw it to the side as they were running, and the dogs would be distracted. So the dogs would go after the red herring instead of going after the thief. You want to drop those red herrings. You want somebody to say, I like Nunzio. I am so sorry. I know he's a gangster, and I'm so sorry he was the one that did X, Y, and Z. And then later, but realize that, you know, that's possible. That's plausible. And then later say, oh, it wasn't him. I'm so glad. You want to fool your reader, but you don't want to treat your reader like a fool. Readers don't like that. So if you throw out a red herring, if it's really from the beginning of the story or movie or television show to the end that everybody's pointing at this one person, and then a new person comes on the scene and says, I did it. People don't like that. If you're going to give me a red herring, let me discover it. Let me find those footprints and go the wrong way. Same thing with clues. And a great thing to do with clues is to divide them among several people. So whatever the clue might be, I want my reader to be saying, if only these three people get together and talk, they'll realize they have they'll have what they need, but they're never getting together. They're not talking. And so you, the reader, you see the clue out there. And by doing that, I'm also increasing tension. And so the parts of plot that you mentioned, Brian, you have to make sure you have a ticking clock. If you're writing a mystery thriller, a clock has to be ticking. It's that you fix the, you cut the right wire when there's only 1 second left. There has to be a dastardly situation. It's what Dan Brown calls crucible. A situation that's just awful. And you have to hook your reader and make them care about the characters. Otherwise, they won't care if the bomb explodes or how the situation goes. So plot is important, and it builds on characters. Story is important, but it is it builds on your idea. So your initial idea is more important to story, what you scribble down. Whereas plot will grow from your characters and their actions and their interactions. The clues are wonderful. Leave them in little pieces. Don't underestimate the reader. Don't leave the same clue twice because you think I might have missed it. If I did, I might go back and find it. Don't underestimate your reader. They want to take part in solving this mystery. They're in it with you.
It really seems to me that plot then is about connection at its core, because even going back to your initial metaphor about the king died, the queen died, or the king died and the queen died of grief, well, it all comes down to the interrelatedness of characters and their relationships, as well as the relationship between events, right? And we tie that back into this idea again of action, reaction, chains, and some of that stems from the fact that we wrote ourselves into corners a bit earlier. So that is at least how I'm kind of thinking about plot after you have summed it up that way, is it kind of comes down to connection. But with story, which is our sixth touchstone, you alluded to this just a little bit. It seems like story then maybe ties into that original idea. It's about something maybe bigger than story, or maybe we need to look at story from a new perspective, and it's this idea of that promise we made to readers back in step one with our idea. So, Nick, can you kind of elaborate on story a little bit more for us now?
So, it used to be fiction writers used to be criticized for wanting to get a message out, and the criticism was always, if you want to send a message, use Western Union. Well, that I disagree with that. I think story, when I started Weepers, I wanted to tell the story of what it's like growing up in poverty in a New York housing project and what life, everyday life is like. But I didn't want to be preachy, and I didn't want to fall back on my sociology background. I wanted to tell the real story. I wanted to involve you in this story about growing up there. And I knew that the best way to tell the truth is with fiction. Nothing tells the truth better than fiction. And so story becomes, to some extent, a story. If you read Weepers, you'll say, you know, this was a story about family, or this was a story about youth coming of age, or this was a mafia story, or this. And there's lots of those pieces in there. And I think messages and truth are important to any story, any genre. It doesn't matter. I always say that you should nod to truth in the story, but it's your writing. And if it's fiction, the first chapter, 1951, New York City, it's snowing. And it's Christmas Eve, and Angela and his father are walking home. And in the research, I found that the New York Times said the headline on 1951, you can look it up, 1951, Christmas Eve, the headline was, "No Snow for Christmas." It did not snow. And I have Angelo and his father walking in the snow. And Angelo says to his father, "I'm glad Nana's newspaper was wrong." And his father says, "They don't get it right all the time at the Times." And that's it. I bow to the truth. And then it's fiction. I want it snowing for a reason. That becomes all part of story weaving. The plot is punching along. The plot is the tension and the timing and taking you to an ending that you're wondering what's going to happen to them and where they're going to be and how soon will we get there. And the clock is ticking. It is a wonderful mix, story and plot. And story requires, and this kind of takes us to the end, story requires you to keep your promises. You make promises when you tell a story. Aside from the plotting and leaving clues, you make promises. It's kind of like the secondary character. You introduce him once, and I like him, and I never see him again. You broke a promise with me. You're not only going to solve the crime, you're going to tell me why I had to meet him.
And it's all about making sure that we are deliberate with all of our storytelling choices along the way, right? And it plays back into this idea you mentioned earlier about minimizing the number of named characters that we have, or as something that I know is a challenge for many people who are writing, say, memoir, or maybe they want to fictionalize real life events, is being comfortable doing things like consolidating characters. Because though art does imitate life and life can imitate art, they aren't perfect mirror images of each other. So even if someone existed in real life, even if it did not in fact snow in real life on that particular day in history, well, we have to be comfortable using our fiction space, the space that we are operating in, to create a story that's going to be engaging, knowing and embracing the idea that it is fiction. And sometimes that means making hard choices, but if we are deliberate about them and we know what the consequences for those choices are going to be, then we're setting ourselves and eventually readers up for something that will be a memorable and enjoyable reading experience. This is it, WritesCast people, the window for submissions for the 72nd annual Jade Ring Writing Contest is about to close. Yes, in the coming weeks from the date of debut of this episode, the Wisconsin Writers Association, who are sponsoring this episode, will be closing their submissions window for the 72nd annual Jade Ring Contest. If you would like to submit your fiction, your nonfiction, your poetry, to have it be judged by one of three, if I do say so myself, pretty cool judges, well, you can still get that in if you get it in before that window shuts. So, to learn more and to submit your fiction and have the shot at earning yourself the coveted Jade Ring, cash prizes, and publication in places like Wisconsin People and Ideas Magazine and Creative Wisconsin Literary Journal, well, you're going to want to head to wiwrite.org and learn more and, crucially, make sure you get those submissions in. So that's right. Again, visit wiwrite.org, and you can even head to wiwrite.org/contests to get directly to the Jade Ring page. So folks, the Jade Ring window, it's closing. This is gonna be one of the last times you hear from me about it, so get in those submissions.
Perfect. And whatever we say, the reader will remember. Even if we said it unintentionally, the reader will remember. And that's also part of both clues, foreshadowing. I think of foreshadowing as clues and the promises you make. So, again, going back to the second one, Angelo says to his father walking home, how come no one stole the Christmas tree on the Journal American newspaper loading dock? His father says to Angelo, who's seven, they belong to Uncle Nunzio. I made three promises in that short exchange. One is that this is a dangerous neighborhood in which Christmas trees will be stolen. Two, Nunzio is not somebody anybody messes with. And three, there's a relationship between Nunzio and Angelo. Calls him Uncle Nunzio. Now, if you don't meet Nunzio in the book, I've broken a cardinal promise. And that was just in a foreshadowing statement. And so all of that has to be there. And you have to be, I actually make a separate list of clues where I left them and foreshadowing so that I can make sure I don't forget it as I'm working through my book.
Because, of course, by the time we get near the end of our manuscript, we want to make sure that all of the details that we have included, all of the clues, all of the foreshadowing adds up to what you call in your seventh touchstone. It needs to add up to that inevitable yet surprising ending. So, Nick, how can we ensure that our endings are in fact inevitable yet surprising?
Good question. And let me add first that you can have some information hanging if you're going to write a sequel. That's a whole different kind of discussion. When my father died, we took him to the neighborhood, of course, Kampala, and we wanted to bury him in his blue suit that he loved, just loved the suit, but it was destroyed. And we explained that to the funeral director that we knew personally. And instead, we brought his golfing sweater, which was the other piece of nice clothing that he owned. And we explained to the funeral director, really loved his blue suit, looked great in his blue suit, would have been perfect, but this is what we got. And the funeral director said, it looks fine, don't worry about it, we'll fix it. Well, 2 days later, we went back for the showing. And my mother and I and my brother, we looked at my father. He was in this beautiful blue suit, just gorgeous, with a handkerchief in the breast pocket. And we were just overwhelmed. And we said, how did you do that? Who paid for this? How did this happen? He said, well, another family came in, and they actually saw your father in the golf sweater. And their deceased was wearing this blue suit. And they said, oh, we should have thought about a golf sweater. He so loved golf. He would have hated being in a suit when he could have been in his golf sweater. So, you know, I figured nobody would mind if we switched. And I said, no, we don't mind. We think it's great. But how did you do it so carefully? Look at the way it fits. And it must have taken you hours. And he said, no, we didn't switch clothes. We switched heads.
No. You got me the second time with that one too, Nick. I know you shared that the first time that we recorded this episode, but second time around, you still got me with that one. That is certainly inevitable, and yes, 100% surprising.
And a fun exercise if you're doing it with like a group of students is to have them write different endings to that. And so I think, I agree, it's inevitable, you know, right from the beginning, he's going to get a blue suit somehow. You just don't know how. And let me say that as a final thing, it's not about the what. It's not about the blue suit. It's about how. And that's the punchline in a mystery thriller, the how.
And I think that what that example illustrates, as you have pointed out here, but I'm going to double down on it because I think it is such an important point that needs to be made, is that from the start, the moment that you chose as the storyteller to call attention to the blue suit, that there wasn't a blue suit, but that he would have really liked the blue suit. Well, look at that. We're spending an awful lot of time as the storyteller mentioning this blue suit, right? And because you have raised awareness about it and you have drawn listeners' attention, in this case, listeners' attention to this idea of the blue suit, listeners will develop the expectation that this comes around full circle. And so you have established a promise. You're going to leave some clues along the way about how we might get there when this other family arrives. And, you know, they mentioned that they saw your father in the golf suit or in the golf sweater, and they had their father in a blue suit. Readers start putting it together in their own minds. They're making predictions. And then, like you say, it all comes down to the how at the end. And it turns out the how was very unexpected, at least if you haven't heard the story before, of course. So an illustration really of so many of the touchstones that you've discussed here. And Nick, I think it's important for listeners to know, is the story that you told about your dad in the funeral parlor, is that true?
No, that's made up. I made it up for every reason you said, because as listeners are getting to see that he now has a blue suit on, they're going after red herrings. They're saying, what a generous funeral home this must have been. They must have just, and those are the red herrings that are out there for them to find. I'm not telling them those things. And then the conclusion is a surprise.
The conclusion certainly was a surprise. The first time you shared that story with me, I sincerely believed for quite a few minutes after you shared it that that had transpired. I was a little mortified, but you clarified that it was not true. So I wanted to make sure listeners knew that it was truly a fiction and a good one at that. So thank you, Nick, for indulging me again. I will say this, you know, we have covered all seven of your touchstones here. I think we've had an opportunity to explore them in some really nice detail. We've shown some great connectivity from step one all the way through seven and kind of reaching beyond that and getting into a reader's mindset as well. So now, Nick, what I want to know from you, because there's always more to learn and to read, where is it then that listeners to this program can find you online?
First of all, my direct email address, the Gmail address, is nick.charkas@gmail.com. My website is www.nickcharkas.com. And if you have questions about writing or anything at all, I will respond to you.
And that's, again, just showing the great generosity of our writing community here, both in our local area, you know, and of course in the RightsCast network writ large as well. So, Nick, we very much appreciate you sharing your insight with listeners today and the opportunity for future follow-up being made available as well. And I, of course, need to end with my own expression of gratitude, Nick. So thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast network.
Brian, I am honored, really, to be part of your RightsCast, so thank you.
That'll do it for my interview of Nick Charkas, author of Weepers. Thanks to Nick for joining me, and thanks to you, dear listeners, for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you could leave the RightsCast Network a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. This will help the RightsCast Network reach more writers like you and building that sense of community. You know how it goes, folks. Building that sense of community is what we, and I hope you, are all about. To those of you who have already left us a rating and review, thank you. I'd also like to thank the RightsCast Network's patrons who contribute to our programming financially at patreon.com/RightsCast. In exchange for their support, RightsCast Network patrons get access to great patron perks like RightsCast Network swag in the form of stickers, t-shirts, and mugs, discounts on my editing services, and entries in monthly drawings for partial manuscript critiques performed by yours truly. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can join patrons like Laura Hazen and Angeline Boley today in supporting our programming directly at $1, $2, or $3 per episode or per month. Any level of contribution will get you access to those fantastic patron perks, so become a supporter today by making your pledge at patreon.com/rightscast. That's patreon.com/rightscast. Thanks as well to our on-air sponsors, Dandelion Web Marketing and the Wisconsin Writers Association. To learn more about them or our other sponsors, you can visit rightscast.net/sponsors. Coming up next on the RightsCast Network is an episode of, whoa, Biblio Breakdown. What's more, I won't be the one leading the episode. Yes, that's right, for the first time ever, we'll be welcoming a new solo host to the RightsCast Network as part of an exciting new network expansion. So stay tuned for the first ever Biblio Breakdown done by new host Ekta Garg. To learn more about Ekta and what she'll be covering in this episode, be sure to check out our website and social media before her episode debuts on May 29th. You can find our website at rightscast.net or say hello to us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at RightsCast or by searching for the RightsCast Network. We're also available by email at rightscast@gmail.com, and you can now call us at area code 608-284-8342, where you can leave a voicemail with questions for future guests or other matters you'd like us to address in our programming. To reach me personally, well, you can visit rrcampbellwrites.com or get in touch on Twitter, where I can be found as @IamRRCampbell. I love hearing from listeners of all backgrounds, so please don't hesitate to reach out. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this is R.R. Campbell signing off. Write on and write well. This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing and the Wisconsin Writers Association, and always streaming at rightscast.net.